KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm a professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, as well as affiliated with UNC Center for Information Technology and Public Life, the University of Milan's Information Society Law Center. Today, I'm very excited to have on a legendary lawyer who's getting a lot of attention right now because of his open and public criticism of the Trump administration. The lawyer is Ty Cobb. Now, Ty, I want to be clear, as a baseball fan, I immediately thought Ty Cobb. I'd love to own one of his baseball cards. My understanding is that Ty is a distant relative of Ty Cobb, but we're not going to be talking about baseball as much as I would like to. Instead, we're going to be talking more broadly about lawyering. Now, many people who listen to Hearsay Culture and are paying attention to daily television news will be familiar with Ty, given his regular appearances on CNN's Aaron Burnett Al French Front Show, as well as other television appearances. But we're going to kind of put most of that aside today, because what I want to talk about with Ty fundamentally is the rule of law. And we're going to discuss the rule of law in the context of Ty's career, which is very interesting and quite diverse. We're going to talk about the role of lawyering, the role of judges, the role of courts, but particularly how they are challenged by today's hypersensitive media environment, the constant cleave lights, the critique, the sharing of information, social media, and the like. Because we're dealing with the kinds of issues that give rise to very strong opinions, it's very important for lawyers to be able to be the arbiters. And they're not the arbiters of truth as much as they are the referees in a lot of ways in how we gather truth. And when we think about advocacy, when we think about justice, when we think about lawyering, a lot of what we do is very focused on process. The kind of stuff which is boring, frankly, to lots of people, including a fair number of lawyers, but which is essential. And a lot of Ty's critiques in recent years have focused as much on process and how law is interpreted, how laws applied or the lack of it, and the role of professionals in those places. So we're going to be talking about those issues as well. I could spend the next 45 minutes doing Ty's introduction, but I think it bears noting some interesting background. Many biographies have referred to Ty as an attorney who handles, for example, on one website, the Bet Your Company litigation. He's a fellow at the American College of Trial Lawyers. He's been listed in Best Lawyers in America in a number of editions of it. He was a partner at Hogan Lovells, a big D.C. firm for almost 30 years, graduate of Harvard Law School, Harvard undergrad, as well as Georgetown Law School, defending a variety of clients from Hudson Foods to the CIA whistleblower Mary McCarthy in 2005. Lots of litigation representing parties that ranged on issues involving, as we're going to talk about, the Grand Canyon Trust early on in his career, to issues involving federal investigations and also special counsel investigations of people of both political persuasions, the major parties in the U.S. He's also someone who has been very focused on thinking about how you represent high-profile clients, which is a skill in its own right and something we're going to talk about here. He is joining us via Zoom on October 15, 2025. Ty, thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule and the various places we appear to chat with my listeners on Hearsay Culture.
Well, it's great to be with you, Dave. Thank you so much for including me.
Let's jump right in, Ty. And I want to kind of get kind of a big question out of the way in front of us, right? You have talked about particularly where we are, October 15, 2025, as being in a time where, as you said on Meet the Press just a couple of weeks ago, that it will take a generation to recover the freedoms that you believe we have lost. And I want to think about lawyering and that issue from a generational perspective. You've been practicing for decades, right? I'm not going to yell out your age. You could do that if you want on the air, but you've been practicing for decades. And here we are in a situation where you see those freedoms being threatened. Tell us what kind of freedoms you're talking about, and then more importantly, as we get into it, the role of lawyers in addressing these issues.
Thank you very much for having me, and that's an important question. I think The freedoms that I'm talking about are those that, frankly, are closely associated with the rule of law, the erosion of which I think is tragic for our country. And I think it's in that, through that lens, the erosion of the rule of law, that the freedoms are fallen by the wayside. The rule of law historically has distinguished our country and our system from third world dictatorships, authoritarian regimes, tyranny. And as it is weakened and assaulted by this administration, we creep closer to those realities. I think the fear of tyranny and dictatorships is quite palpable and real among thinking adults these days. And I think if you look at First Amendment freedoms, clearly, the Jimmy Kimmel situation, the Brendan Carr, overplaying the authority of the FCC and targeting content, which is anti-American and anti-First Amendment. I think that's a very real danger. And obviously, the efforts to try to push, media outlets, significant media outlets, into the hands of, people who are sympathetic to Trump and rely upon him economically is, well underway and successful. We've seen wholesale changes, the Washington Post, CBS, Paramount. I think those things are all dangerous. And ideally, some of the rules and regulations that we have in place may thwart the attempted takeover of content, but it's proved to be a almost a losing battle so far. I think also you see in the immigration world a threat to some of the equal protections that historically have applied to law enforcement in terms of being able to detain and question people merely because of their ethnicity or skin color. Now, I don't want to pretend that that is as egregious as some in the media suggest, because it's obvious in immigration cases, that you're not going to go up and question, your average white person as opposed to your average Hispanic. But at the same time, what we have is we had a Hispanic this week in I believe it was in Chicago, detained and actually detained for a considerable period of time, despite the fact that she had a passport reflecting her American citizenship. So that's clearly wrong. Separating nursing mothers from their children and throwing them on the ground and zip tying them—that's clearly wrong. The spectacle of cruelty and the force with which these things are being done—I don't think that was the original intention. Certainly not the intention of the voters that thought we should do something to tighten up the border. I don't think they conceived the cruelty that we're now seeing as part and parcel of that, nor does it have to be. But it is part of the authoritarian playbook, which is to intimidate people with through the use of force. And I think those fears are growing. Likewise, voting rights.
Which
the
the Supreme
invasion
Court
of
was
American
arguing
cities.
today. I mean, that was heard
Yes,
today from the
exactly.
Supreme Court.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because I think that case probably is more noteworthy in the press than it actually should be. I mean, the Voting Rights Act was intended to sunset at some point. It's been around for, I don't know, well over maybe 50 years now. The issue there is, can you redistrict for partisan reasons if they don't impact equal protection reasons? And I think, constitutionally, that's a close call. I think to damn the Supreme Court if they pull back a little bit, on that, may not be entirely fair. I mean, obviously, I wish it wouldn't happen. I think the act has been very effective and very helpful, to America. Certainly increased minority representation in the halls of Congress and state houses and judgeships. But but it's not, it's constitutionally, it's a much closer call than I think, you know, it's being portrayed as. And I say that just because we're at a point where the Constitution is really being stressed. I don't think the founders designed it with, you know, with the possibility in their minds that, you know, 77 million Americans would vote for somebody, you know, quite as evil and deranged as our current president. But and the safeguards that they built in are largely in Article One. Not Article 3. I mean, the court alone, without the support of the legislature, is not a sufficient stopgap to halt Article 2 excesses of the type that we're seeing from President Trump.
Well, you know, let's get into it, because I wanted to use that to kind of then take a step back and think about how we got here and sure. what we should do. And by we, again, I do mean the public. I don't just mean lawyers. You know, I'm referring to the case Louisiana v. Calais for listeners, which was argued this morning in the U.S. Supreme Court. Again, it's October 15th. And, you know, the issue there, generally speaking, involves the question of whether race can play a role in how we interpret the Voting Rights Act. And of course, this is the kind of, and I know I'm being very simple on it, but the point is that this is exactly the kind of issue that requires nuance, right? You have just made, Ty, right? You've offered a nuanced opinion based upon the law and your interpretation of it. I could take a different position. We could go back and forth. And we seem to, and this is a perfect example of it, we seem to have lost that ability. Right. This is the kind of issue that and I'm a radio show host. This is on KZSU Stanford. Right. I don't have the resources, as you know, of CNN and others. I don't have libel lawyers backing me up. I'm not running things through that. I happen to be an attorney. But as you know, right, the attorney that represents themselves as a fool for a client. Right. The old saying. And so here's an example of not only nuance, but risk. Right? The risk of having a conversation, the risk of discussing nuance, even though, as you point out, and I think it's fair to say, certainly constitutional lawyers would say there may be strong opinions, but it's a debatable point. The role of debate, the role of nuance, seems to be one that I think lawyers still understand, but is lost in our political discourse and certainly lost in our discussion of these kinds of issues. What's your reaction to that issue, and how do you see lawyers helping address those kinds of concerns?
I think lawyers are trained, as you and I have been, to be able to argue both sides, to think in duality, and can be very helpful in these things. I mean, as I said, it's a very close call, I think, constitutionally. I think you could justify extending the voting Article 2 of the Voting Rights Act, or Section 2, and you know, keeping it in full force and effect, you could, as the court has, you know, over the last 10 years or so, toy with the possibility that, you know, the sunset time is upon us in terms of some of the distinctions that are imposed there. But you can have a rational debate. It doesn't require hating somebody who takes the other position. And, you know, in America now, we're so divided. There are a bunch of nonsense positions that people are forced to take. You know, I mean, think about the people who defend Tom Homan. Guy's on videotape, right, and audio tape, taking $50,000 in cash in a bag. And MAGA, you know, thinks fine. You know, it wasn't a crime and no big deal. And the guy still has his position. That never would have occurred at any time in our history prior to 9 months ago. And the guy would be, you know, if not prosecuted, he certainly wouldn't still have his job as the borders are. And you know, I mean, is he ashamed? Well, you haven't seen him on TV responding, but the shame doesn't seem to land on the supporters. And some of the silly things that happen, like Trump's, you know, persistent claim that we've got $17 trillion in tariff money when that's probably inflated by 97%. You know, people are out there talking about, you know, what a great job he's done, you know, economically. Economically, we're on the verge of stagflation. You know, joblessness is rising and inflation's rising. One other time in history under Jimmy Carter, you know, that happened and it lasted 8 years. It's not a pleasant thing. And people just aren't dealing with reality. And obviously, That's in large part a communications issue, as you highlight, and the ability to have a civil conversation about the facts without somebody saying you're lying or you don't know what you're talking about is something that I think we've lost and had saved us in the past.
It's one of those things where, in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, so what is the response that you might have to the Homan situation, right? Where at least what we know publicly seems to be pretty strong evidence to suggest that there's a problem. On the other hand, I could imagine someone saying in a world that does exist, well, right, innocent until proven guilty, charges haven't been brought, and we have a Justice Department. Now, clearly, we could spend the rest of the show talking about changes, to put it mildly, in the Justice Department under the current Attorney General. But I come back to that point because here's an example of where facts and evidence should rule. We know that there is abject changes that you've talked about extensively in other media outlets with regard to the decisions that are made for who's prosecuted, who isn't, of course, the pardons for the January 6th rioters. And it almost feels like the conversation we are having right now is antiquated, is quaint, and the cynicism which drives current debate almost makes people feel like, well, those are two lawyers having a discussion, but that doesn't really reflect reality. Is that where we are?
Well, a little bit. And frankly, you know, so I'm struck by your presentation of the Homan situation because it reflects how effective the White House has been, you know, in seeding the view that because charges haven't been brought, you know, there's no crime.
Yeah, right. And I make that point, right,
to put
the counter position out there, which is where the debate is. Yeah.
I think you should. And I think that's helpful to the point that I'm going to make, which is it highlights the emphasis on the necessity of understanding the facts, because the facts are not that that was a crime. The facts are that the Justice Department, that the FBI agents involved in the case had planned to go back to Homan's, you know, in January and February, and perfect the bribe, perfect the ask, right, and further tighten the case. It was those investigative steps that were designed, you know, to complete the investigation that were halted by, you know, Patel and the Justice Department. So once you add those in there, you know, I mean, it's not that, you know, the initial, you know, steps that were investigative steps, you know, didn't highlight his criminal intent. Of course they did. You don't take $50,000 in a paper bag. You know, Spiro Agnew took cash at the White House. Even he was prosecuted. Homan took $50,000 in cash. He probably uses it to buy his Egg McMuffins. But the reality is that was not the full investigation. The full investigation was halted before it could be completed with perfecting the actual, you know, request for action associated with the payment.
I skipped intentionally in my introduction of you, right, the thing about which you are most known, certainly to the general public, right, which is from roughly June 2017 to June 2018, you served in the White House in the role of handling and helping advise on the Russia investigation. And I intentionally didn't put that in the introduction because there may actually be some people that don't know that background about you, because the moment that we put the current president into the mix, right, people go to corners. Now, again, for understandable reasons,
yes,
many people are in corners, and there are those that look at Trump and more or less say, you're familiar with this viewpoint, I don't like him personally, but I like the policy outcomes, whatever they are, whether it's lower taxes, whether it's lower regs, or whether it's something worse. And of course, you have on the other side people that view Trump as having caused all of the problems that we have. Somewhere in there, right, is again probably a better understanding of where we are and where we might be going. And I'm curious how, given your representation of the president, which you've said in prior interviews, right, you initially took, and I, of course, respond to this as well if you'd like, that you initially took the role to represent the institution of the presidency and to protect that institution, and then the position changed, and of course, you subsequently left the White House and have become a critic of the president. And in coming into that role, right, and in having these discussions, invariably it reverts back to our current president. Can we address the kinds of issues that we have today, the kinds of freedoms to which you referred are being threatened, right, in a way that doesn't reduce to Trump this, Trump that? Because it seems like we have to fundamentally in order to get past this issue and to try to then restore the freedoms to which you referred.
So, yes, I think we can, and I think we do have to, because it's not just Trump. It's 77 million people who voted for him. And, you know, let's take a recent example. So yesterday, you know, we saw despicable texts exchanged by young Republican leadership.
That was reported by Politico.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, everybody and their grandmother has said, you know, how racist, how horrible, you know, the level of racism and fascism that was resorted to. You know, I mean, there were people saying, I love Hitler. Right. There were people, you know, talking about, you know, monkeys and watermelons and just it's just horrible. Yeah, un-American.
It was horrifying.
And nobody in their right mind could defend it except J.D. Vance, our vice president, you know, going, oh, no, this is nothing. Look at what the Democrats did. I mean, the whataboutism response. I mean, give me a break. I mean, it goes back to Trump's suggestion that he could kill somebody on Fifth Avenue and his supporters wouldn't care. I think that's true. And that's the problem that the country faces, which is, you know, people need to be able to communicate with people who believe that in a way that is persuasive.
Yep.
And you can't do that by, you know, violence. You can't do that by, you know, cutting them out. You can't do that by, you know, anger. You have to figure out a you know, compassionate, intelligent way to deal with people, which goes back to your earlier point of why can't we just all get along? Rodney King, you know what I mean? Why can't we just talk about these things? Because if you talk about them and sort through the facts, you know, the American way has been everybody's entitled to an opinion and you put them out there, you know, under the First Amendment with freedom to say what you think for a good reason, which is in order to receive feedback and educate yourself and learn. I mean, are you right? Are you wrong? Are people offended? If they're offended, is that your fault or is it something, you know, inherent in them? You know, that's the American way of sharing ideas and growing. You know, that growth has been stopped. It's been halted by the divisiveness that we, you know, are suffering through. And your earlier point about, you know, we've got to figure out a way to talk to each other is an excellent point.
And it seems like the because of the wholesale destruction of norms, put aside respecting the law, which is also now debated, that we're not able to, and understandably in October 2025, I mean, the second term has only really just started. God only knows what's going to happen in the next 3 years. But it seems like the time has to be now, while we still have living memory and recent memory of a different style of norms, to say enough's enough. I ask you this because in the context of not just lawyering, but in the context of political discourse, to which you pay attention, there's been a lot of praise for Governor Newsom in his social media efforts to mock the style of communication that the White House has put out with these grotesque memes and not to mention falsehoods. And I ask you that as a style of communication because lawyers think about how we communicate, right? We think about how we present stories. You've represented clients that were vilified, right, over a period of 40 years. What's the role of storytelling and what's the role of having those discussions publicly that we might learn from your experience to help improve our public discourse?
That's a toughie.
Yeah. These are the kinds of questions I'm going to keep throwing at you, counsel.
Good.
Yeah.
I will say, I think a huge part of the problem. So let's take the parliamentary system, for example, you know, Great Britain, Canada, you know, where yes, somebody's in power, but the other side has a leader. You know, the other sides have a leader, a spokesperson who combats, you know, the governing party daily in debate. and you know, as a standard bearer for you know, for the philosophy that they're urging. You know, what we have now in with the Democrats, I mean, we've got Schumer and Jeffries and Newsom and AOC, you know, none of whom are effective messengers. You know, it's essential that, in my view, that somebody emerge, whether it's Mark Kelly, Governor Beshear, you know, Governor Whitmer, whomever, and become a counterpoint to Trump, because it's a vacuum right now. It's basically Trump doing whatever he wants, and you know, a lot of people, you know, reacting and saying nasty, 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 you know, bad, 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 but not reminding America of the virtues and the values that are necessary to combat the evil that we're experiencing. And I guess my response to what you just said is messaging is key, and there is no messaging. There are a lot of individuals out there saying things, doing the best they can to highlight the actual facts that are happening. But there's just not anybody out there saying this has to stop and I'm going to stop it. And I hope that person comes forward.
You've talked in other interviews about your representation of the Grand Canyon Trust, which helped me understand some of the early antecedents of Ty Cobb, the attorney that represented all these other entities. Tell us a little bit before we take our break. Tell us a little about that experience, which goes back now 40 years, right? Or more, right? Actually, more than 40 years is my understanding, and how it influenced the later representations that you had, including the current president.
So I'm getting old, but I think it was actually only maybe 35 years ago.
Oh, was it 35? Okay.
I was going to say, I think it was like 89 and 90.
Oh, I thought it was 30. Earlier 80s. Okay. Okay. Thanks.
But, no, so in the early 80s, I was a federal prosecutor and head of the Organized Crime Drug Enforcement Task Force for the Mid-Atlantic region. But in the late 80s, when I was first in private practice, I got hooked up with the Grand Canyon Trust in a case in Utah involving the operation of Glen Canyon Dam and the consequences to the Colorado River from the way that was operated, and won an injunction against the Department of Energy from a judge who was very reluctant to grant that, but ultimately legally had no choice. And that wedded me to the organization. I went on the board. I was the chairman of the board. I was on the board for, you know, over 25 years, maybe, and chairman for five, and you know, had some great experiences there, including initiating some of the landmarks we now have, like Bear's Ears and the Escalante Staircase and other things. So very much a passion for the country, the beauty of the West, and the indigenous people who the country has, you know, shafted so badly over, you know, 300 years. It was a labor of love for me, and being able to achieve some of those victories in court against long odds, you know, very fulfilling.
Mm-hmm. And with that early experience, and I'm glad you mentioned your even early experience as a prosecutor, I noted in interviews that in early experiences with the law, you recognized the need for there to be skills in areas other than the areas you were interested in, which is another legal concept of parity, right? The idea that we level the playing field so that the truth will out. And that seems to have been also a big aspect of the kinds of clients that you've decided to represent and the kinds of issues you decided to take on.
So it's interesting that you raised that. I hadn't thought about this in a long time, but I have to credit Ben Civiletti, former attorney general, a friend of mine, who, when I was a young lawyer interviewing for jobs, advised me, gave me some advice. He said, one thing I recommend is that you pick an area that is outside your, you know, wheelhouse, and, you know, focus on it intellectually, you know, because it will help you just in terms of the discipline required to understand the complex issues that you're going to encounter. It will help you in that regard. And I picked conservation and the West. And as a result, I got to do some things that I never would have imagined, and things that were among the most enjoyable in my life.
Let's take a little break here. We're chatting with Ty Cobb, attorney on Hearsay Culture on KZSU FM Stanford. KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford that requires donations, right? Particularly in this very crowded and also complex media environment to stay on the air. So we encourage you to make donations by reaching us at donate@kzsu.stanford.edu. Also check out Hearsay Culture Network, my co-host Denise Howell, and our programming. You can find us at hearsayculture.com. Ty, let me jump right now to a clip that I want to share with you. I want to kind of pivot a bit to these bigger issues regarding lawyers and the role of law and our judicial system, which again is under so much scrutiny, also under so much pressure right now, and kind of get your reaction to some of these things. So one of my heroes is the late Arthur Lyman, right? Who, if people aren't familiar, was a partner of Paul Weiss, which is a big firm for decades, was involved in the Iran-Contra investigation and a variety of other very high profile, both public policy as well as private litigation over a period of 40 years. He was on Charlie Rose's show during the O.J. Simpson trial, right, which it seems like a century ago. It was really only about 30 years ago, which is still a long time. And he was asked by Charlie Rose why it was that so many people were concerned about the O.J. Simpson trial being televised and what it meant for law. I want to play his answer to that question and then get your reaction to it.
What's happened? What is it about the Simpson trial that has embarrassed those who care about the administration of justice in America?
I think there's always been some tension between the ends and means of justice. The end, clearly, of a justice system is to determine guilt or innocence, giving the defendant the benefit of the doubt, and giving the defendant the presumption of innocence. And that's an important tradition and principle. The means is the adversarial system. And what has happened in the Simpson case is that the means, the contest between the lawyers, has become the end in and of itself. And there's almost no focus at all on the issues that really are at stake in that case.
Go ahead.
I think the potential for a case getting out of control is always there, but we depend on a judiciary to maintain some degree of order and some degree of focus, and that has failed, perhaps because of the television, the highly publicized nature of the case.
I find it really interesting that here we have Lyman, right, 30 years ago talking about the role of the media and the lights, but also a trial which shed a lot of public negative reaction to lawyers and judges and the spectacle. What's your reaction to that comment 30 years later with all of the additional experiences we've had with public prosecutions, public trials, right? The public ridicule of judges more recently, protests in front of judges' homes, and on and on.
I think it's very relevant to this time because, you know, Arthur Lyman, who was a titan and somebody I think any person who's devoted their life to litigation, as I have, you know, reveres and admires. He's right about the failure, particularly of the judge. The judge demeaned himself really openly by his fecklessness and inability to control the courtroom, and let theatrics overwhelm the facts. I think we all saw that and recognized that, you know, that was a significant part of what went on. But I think what you see today is, that this administration doesn't rely on judges to, shoot themselves in the head. It attacks them willy-nilly. And you've got, excellent judges, nonpartisan judges, and even Trump appointees that the president has attacked merely because they've ruled against some atrocity that he thought was appropriate. I think detracting from the respect due the institutions is right out of the authoritarian playbook. Mm-hmm. If you can denude an institution of the respect that it it needs to be successful, then you empower yourself. And the Project 2025 people and others in this administration, I think have made that very clear to the president. It fits in well with his crippling narcissism, where you respond to any insult with vengeance. These attacks have been unprecedented. They're not remotely, fact-based. When a judge in Portland, who's a Republican appointee, says, "Whoa, stop, this is wrong, you can't do this," and she gets attacked personally, that's not American, but it is definitely what we're seeing now. And it's all about, disempowering the judiciary with the hope of inflating the power of the executive.
What's your take on how the judiciary broadly has handled this pressure? And I want to put the Supreme Court aside for a moment because of all of the political issues there and at least two justices, who have ethics issues, and focus on the more bread and butter trial and appellate courts. What's your take on how the trial and appellate courts have handled the current pressure that the judiciary faces?
So if you don't mind, my answer is going to be inclusive of the Supreme Court, but not in a political way.
Okay, fair enough.
I think what we've seen is that the district courts, on the front lines, for the most part, which is all you can expect because no system is perfect. And no matter, you've got hundreds of district court judges and they're not all going to get it right on the same day. Right. But for the most part, what you've seen is district court judges taking these issues very seriously, human rights, and the very new experience of having government lawyers just lie to them. Mm-hmm. I think what we've seen is the erosion of the rule of normalcy, which, we've had for 200 years or more, which basically boils down to when the government makes a representation, the presumption is it's in good faith. That's gone by the wayside now. That's not part of our jurisprudence in the modern era, particularly when the Justice Department has fired lawyers for telling the truth in court. I think what we see now is as evidence as the Emil Bove and Pam Bondi makes clear that, they're sending lawyers into court, to defy judges and to misrepresent the government's position if it helps them with their advocacy. And that is so dangerous. And I think in response to that, it's been so unprecedented and so scary for the district court judges who have encountered it that they have responded forcefully and effectively to that. Now, it's probably caused a couple of rulings that, are erroneous, merely because the government was so aggressive, that have been corrected in some part by the appellate courts and subsequently by the Supreme Court in the sense of, measuring the president's powers. And I think the courts are I think the simple answer is, I think the district court judges have performed flawlessly. I think the appellate courts have dealt very well with most of the issues that they've confronted. I think the Supreme Court, has taken those decisions and, where possible, upheld them. But when they are forced, as is their unique position, to measure the decisions up against the real Article II powers that the president has, and the fact that the founders armed Congress with the job of controlling an evil president or a bad president, and the courts play a less empowered role, and certainly a lagging role. I think the Supreme Court, has been in a terrible position because, as I say, the founders did not necessarily give them the tools, unlike Congress, which has the tools. The courts don't really have the tools to say, that's not what we want in America. This would be better. They're stuck with saying, is this constitutional? And, in Article 2, the president's powers are so extreme by design that they don't have a lot of choice in some of these cases. Now, have they gone too far in some of the cases? I think they went further than they needed to in the immunity case, but I don't think it was ever a question among constitutional lawyers or law professors that official acts were immune from criminal prosecution. I think that's been the assumption since 1973 and the Nixon opinion, which went into great detail about the importance of official acts and the distinction that they played under the Constitution. But yes, they went further than I would have preferred. And frankly, every time they rule for Trump, you know, I'm bothered. But at the same time, are they right? I think they're right, you know, a lot of the time, simply because the Constitution doesn't give them the leeway to say, we would rather this. You know, they're stuck with saying, yes, you have that power. Yeah. And Congress has given the president those powers in many instances. For example, you know, the planned invasion of, you know, blue states, right. California, yes. Chicago, Oregon, by the president and his directive to his generals that, you know, they practice soldiering in against Americans in our cities. You know, I think what you see there is, you know, a raw exercise in power, but it's a power that Congress, you know, has recognized that they went too far on years ago in the Insurrection Act. That there have been attempts to clean that up over the last decade that neither side has followed through on. But under the Insurrection Act, Trump's ability to send troops into virtually anywhere that he wants to is largely unrestricted. So I think people need to understand the wide powers that a president has. You know, the fact that the founders assumed that an informed electorate would never install a president of this president's temperament or character. Yep. And that if it happened, that Congress would be, you know, front and center. But, you know, Congress is, you know, out of the game. They've been neutered by the, you know, cowardice of the Republicans. And, you know, I mean, you know, Congress not in session. Why? Congress hasn't been in session much of this year simply because of the fact Speaker Johnson doesn't want to take a vote on the Epstein files.
You know, and again, you know, I am tempted, Ty, to take on these issues, but I know that my colleagues in the press are asking those questions, and I want to focus us.
Sure,
in light. No, I'm not asking you to change your answer, and I'm not suggesting you're not answering a question. I want to be clear to my listeners that I want to bring up some other issues related to them that I'm not hearing discussed as much, that I think makes hearsay culture the kind of place you want to listen. And so I want to take that critique, right? Mm-hmm. And use it to, with the follow-up question of the enforcement powers of the courts, right? Mm-hmm. Which is an issue that I don't think gets nearly enough attention, but people that focus on the judiciary have been concerned about. We haven't yet seen, other than a few instances where the Trump administration more or less said publicly, we're going to either ignore the court's order with regard to the movement of individuals, right, out of the United States, right, when in a famous situation involving the literal turnaround of planes and other commentary. But we haven't really seen yet the fundamental challenge to the simple fact that the judiciary doesn't have an army. Right. As you just alluded to me, the biggest concern that I have right now, and there's a lot of them, is very much what you just said, the fact that the U.S. military is now being used in ways that we have not seen. And when you have the president of the United States saying to generals, as you just alluded to, right, and this was in the meeting that the Secretary of Defense, I'm not going to call him Secretary of War because Congress has to make that change, right, had said, had brought together, and the president says training ground, that's a huge concern. The courts could stop that too, and we could debate the Insurrection Act. And we haven't yet seen, right, the court's enforcement powers challenged. Are you concerned that that's coming, or that, and is that something we should be concerned about?
Yes, I think so. I think you have to look at Trump's assault on the rule of law in a linear fashion, and he's broken virtually every norm except that one. And even there, you know, we have multiple rulings now, including one this week, by a court who said, I enjoined this and you did a workaround that is identical. You defied my order. I'm reordering you to do this. I think that's coming. I think the tragedy there, though, goes back to the answer, my long-winded answer on the last question, which is the court doesn't have a self-enforcing capability.
Right.
They don't have anybody, who can, stranglehold or, zip tie, people who defy their orders other than through the contempt power. And, that's not going to, change Trump's desire to invade our cities. I think, again, it's an area where, Congress has to step up if they will. And if they won't, the constitutional remedy is insufficient, but it's the ballot box.
We've seen, and we have about 15 minutes left. I want to ask you some of these questions based upon your experience in the White House. Again, not the questions you've been asked elsewhere. A lot of people thought coming into this new administration that yes, we were not going to see, to put it clearly and directly, the professionals that we had seen in Trump one, and we've certainly, and the president more or less said, and he's followed through, that he's going to bring in people who whose first loyalty appear to be to him, and that seems to have played out. But others expressed the hope or perhaps optimistic view that it would be, and I'll use the phrase that you often hear in Washington, right, the quote-unquote normies, right, the normal people, the people in middle-level roles, the career professionals who would be able to rein in the worst instincts of not just the president but perhaps his nominees. Now, obviously, DOGE and the attack that the OMB director, right, has created around hollowing out the government certainly impacts that. But I've been struck by the fact that somewhere in this miasma, and we've only been at this for about 10 months, there are these people still in government, right? And you were among them who went in to represent the institution, who wound up representing the president, and then found yourself incapable for professional and other reasons of continuing representation in the left, and now you're criticizing. But there are obviously lots of people still inside government who are trying to do that work. Now, the DOJ, obviously, we've seen continual resignations, which are horrific, but there are lots of other federal agencies who largely do their work behind the scenes where those people exist. Based upon your experience in the first administration, do you see that that's still occurring, and can the American public have confidence, right, that those people in place who we may never hear of, who may never talk about, right, will be able to at least maintain the rule of law? Hey, there's a regulation here that we need to follow. Hey, there's a process that we need to follow, right? Or do you see that over, and I know you don't have a crystal ball, but do you see that over the next few years eroding to the point where we don't have those professionals inside the federal government?
I think we're losing them very rapidly. I mean, keep in mind that every single, roadblock that Trump faces. For example, today there was a New York Times reporting about the U.S. attorney in the Western District of Virginia who was forced to resign because he wouldn't pursue an investigation. Anytime somebody is an impediment to the authoritarian whims of this president or his attorney general or others, they get fired. The Justice Department has really been hollowed out in terms of experience. The FBI, leadership is, has been cut by at least 60%. And stay in the FBI, people who used to do counterterrorism to keep us safe, and terrorism investigations and major fraud cases, of the size of, Trump's real estate fraud or, the $400 million plane that he illegally accepted. Those people have been reassigned to immigration cases. So I see that depletion well underway and making the world very dangerous for us. But it gets to an important point because I've had some, not, frequent, but I've had a few conversations with senior people about, should I resign? Should I leave?
Yeah.
And my advice is please don't.
Yeah. Right.
stay as long as you can. We need good people in government if we're going to have a good government. Mm-hmm. You know, we can't have a government full of the RFK Juniors, the Hegsehs, the Patels, you know, and survive. Mm-hmm. We need people there of character and integrity. And experience. These are difficult issues. I know that government employees often get a bad rap, but some of the selfless things that people do for insignificant sums because they love their country and they like the responsibility or the exercise of discretion that they're allowed to do, to stretch their own character and serve the country. Are really substantial and significant, and people don't get enough credit for it. But the more people that leave, the replacements are going to be sycophants and loyalists, and we can't afford that.
How did that analysis play into your decision to leave the first administration?
So I'm glad you asked that. It's a little different than what you suggested. I was largely done. I took the job, for a variety of reasons. I have a history of public service in the Justice Department and a special counsel and working on the Hill and other things. And I always enjoyed public service. And it was an important issue, I thought, for the country, because the issue was, was the president somehow co-opted by colluding with Russia? Nobody actually knew the truth at the time. And, but Mueller was a friend of mine. Mueller was a longstanding friend of mine. And I thought that he and I could fashion a process that would, be as not as divisive as might otherwise occur. And we were able to get through the entire investigation without a subpoena, without a court hearing, without a shouting match, other than ultimately at the end about whether Trump would be interviewed. And the whole process of White House cooperation and turning over everything and full and complete cooperation with regard to documents and providing witnesses had eliminated the leverage that Mueller had to force that legally. And, they chose not to do it. I was largely done, but I did leave because one of the conditions of my employment was that the president would not continue to criticize Mueller personally, so that it would make my job easier, and I thought it'd be better for the country. And once the president's legal team started to change, and Rudy came in, the president and Rudy were very vituperative about Mueller, and that was really time for me to leave. Most of the cooperation had been completed. All the interviews had been completed. So I thought I was largely done. I wish I'd have had a little bit of longer a runway, but it was definitely time for me to go.
Yeah. So I appreciate that clarification. And what would you have done with that longer runway had you had the opportunity?
I think I would have pressed the issue of getting the report out. They didn't learn anything, in the last 14 months of the existence of the Mueller investigation that they didn't already know, much earlier. I think it did hamstring the country internationally, the pendency of that investigation. And as we know, it dug a deep hole in Trump's psyche, that we're now paying for with some of these revenge prosecutions and his vengeance, his whole persona and view of what he's going to do with his power. So I think he definitely felt victimized, and I wish I could have mitigated that more, but it is what it is.
On Frontline, you had talked about your experience discussing not directly lawyers, but how the president sees lawyers. Could you share that perspective for those that, particularly law students, who might be wondering, how does this president, we could see the obvious actions, but how does this president actually think about lawyers, right, based upon your experience?
Well, I think it's evolved somewhat. I think early in his career with Roy Cohn, he saw, Cohn as an umbrella against the rain. Cohn was, somebody whose ethics were non-existent and whose morals probably the same. But what he did for Trump, I think, gave Trump a false sense of what lawyers do, whether it's destroy documents, refuse to produce things, lie. I think his expectations for what lawyers would do for him were shaken in the first term. And he was very well represented personally. I think Jay Sekulow and John Dowd in particular did an excellent job for him. But they would have nothing to nothing to do with the Roy Cohn style. They were very very ethical and very professional in the guidance they gave him. I think now he sees lawyers more like knives and forks. I mean, they're utensils. You know, and they only exist to do what he tells them to do. You know, for example, let's go to Mar-a-Lago, you know, where he lied to his lawyer, Evan Corcoran, about whether he still retained the documents, and had Evan Corcoran pass that lie along to the Justice Department. And there was an affidavit created that was completely fraudulent, you know, that the lawyers didn't know was fraudulent, but Trump used them, in a way that, you know, is clearly improper, if not illegal. And I think that's really, you know, what he expects now. He's back to the expectation that people will do anything he wants them to do. And clearly Pam Bondi shares that view if she's firing people who tell the truth in court and directing lawyers to misrepresent facts.
Let me, two more questions for you, Ty. I mentioned Arthur Lyman, who is a professional hero of mine. When I look at my heroes, you know, a lot of them were people who worked across party lines to try to get stuff done. I was involved early on with the Concord Coalition, late Senator Rudman, sure. People like Alan Simpson, more recently, John McCain, people who just said, you know, let's get things done here. Of course, you know, Daniel Patrick Moynihan in New York, I mean, others. So, you know, I'm very much policy driven and putting aside clubs, putting aside, putting people in boxes to get things done for the American people. And I'm curious who your heroes are, who your mentors have been in how you practice and how you serve the public.
Well, my dad is my biggest hero. He was a Navy fighter pilot. I was the oldest of eight kids. We didn't have a lot, but, you know, we had a great life. I grew up in a little town in western Kansas, and he taught me a lot, you know, including the fact that, doing the next right thing is always the most important, you know, concept you should have. And it'll get harder, when the right thing is not necessarily the popular thing, but you got to, it's even more important to do it. So, my dad, definitely my biggest hero, but, I had others. When I was 10 years old, I was involved in my first campaign, for Bob Dole, who was a friend of my father's in Kansas. And then, you know, you mentioned one of them, John McCain. I worked very closely with John McCain, to pass the Grand Canyon Protection Act, in Congress after we had gotten the injunction that was the predicate for that act. And this is a man who, cast the deciding vote not to eliminate Obamacare, and the person who, you know, shut down audiences when they would criticize Obama, you know, personally when he was campaigning. So I think people with standards, I think people that are fearless and demonstrate character. There are a lot of them out there. You can learn, you know, as much. My dad used to always say, you know, it's just as important to listen to the guy who operates the elevator back in days where elevators were operated by people as it is to the guy on the top floor. And I think we can all learn from each other, but we have to listen to each other first. And that goes back to your initial point of why can't we just talk about these things and work it out?
One sentence, advice for lawyers, for particularly law students today, given the fraught world that we're in.
Trust your instincts. Do the next right thing.
Ty Cobb, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture. Thanks for taking the time, and I look forward to having you back on the show.
Great, Dave. Thank you very much. Enjoyed it.